The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program. Thank you for joining us today. Let's run through our announcements. For those of you who would like to call us and talk with our guest, Dr. Bill Rowe, that toll-free number, which will be opened in a few minutes, is 1-866-687-7223. There are no call screeners on the line, so do let it ring. Be patient. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. I'll also answer the phone during the break, and I will hold you over during a break. So again, the number is 1-866-687-7223. As soon as I open the line after we've given Dr. Rowe a few minutes to put forth what it is he wants to talk about, I will let you know about that. You can also email us at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And do visit our website, thespaceshow.com, and there you will find the comprehensive newsletter, and it goes up Sunday after our live program. It has all of the details of the week's programs on it, the full guest bios, and the coming attractions for the Space Show. In fact, this is the only place you will find coming attractions. Also, if we need to change our programming for any reason during a week or get an announcement out to you, you're going to find it first on the website newsletter. So do check it from time to time to stay current. You can also subscribe to our very short email newsletter, which goes out very early in the morning on Monday, California time. It just has a few lines about the week's program, won't clutter up your inbox. Send your subscription request to drspace@thespaceshow.com, or you can use the pop-up window that will occur on that website if you're not blocking pop-ups. Remember that everything we do is archived, so you can listen right off of our website, or you can download our programs quite easily. We go back to May of 2001, and we're approaching 1,800 programs. There's a store on our website. You'll see it up near the top called Space Show Gear. Please do check it out. And above all, you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a nonprofit 501c3 with One Giant Leap Foundation. org, and this program only exists because of your generosity and support. Remember that if you're paying U.S. taxes, you do get a deduction. If you pay California taxes, also the same, you do get a deduction. Do remember that we're trademarked and copyrighted. You do have permission to download the programs. They are in a compressed MP3 format, but a 90-minute program is around 40 megabytes. So if you need any help with how to do that, please get a hold of me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please don't do anything commercial with the programs. No edits, no private YouTube channels, and written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own use. And we're podcasting. You can find our podcasting URL, the RSS URL, if you want to subscribe to it on our website. Both of our newsletters, we are thankful to Andrew over at gigadial.net. for providing us with our podcasting service. You can find us in iTunes and Zune and a host of other places. And then finally, do remember that we are brought to you in part by the Secure World Foundation. They promote cooperative solutions for space security, and you can get much more information from them by visiting their website, secureworldfoundation.org. And I'm happy to bring back one of our favorite, all-time favorite guests, Dr. William Rowe, Dr. Bill Rowe. He has a great website that you should probably open up and follow along with us, because he does refer to it during our discussions. It is www.femins, F-E-M-I-N, S-P-A-C-E, FEMS in space, one word, .com. Dr. Rose, a board-certified internal med doctor. He has specialized in the work on cardiovascular advantages of young females in space. He is the author of many peer and non-peer-reviewed articles on this and many other subjects. Dr. Rowe is a specialist in gender differences for astronaut selection, human physiology in space, when to best take spacewalks, and a lot more. His website, which we just mentioned, femsinspace.com, has a wealth of information for his papers, scientific information, and related material. He also addresses issues that relate to long-term space travel, Mars colonization. He has received many awards over the years. He's been a very, very successful space show guest over the years, and he's listed in Marquis's Who's Who, and he's also an adventure traveler. We could do a show just about his adventure traveling, and we were just talking about crocodiles and elephants and hippos, but we'll have to save that for another day. Dr. Rowe, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you today?
Just great, David. Anxious to be on, and it's a real privilege and an honor.
Well, the honor, of course, is talking to you, and anyone who wades across a river with crocs in it staring at you, you deserve more than being on the space show, let me tell you.
Well, I feel sorry for my wife.
She did it too, right?
Oh, sure.
Oh, sure. You sound like it's just regular mundane activities to do. Maybe it is in Africa. I don't know. Bill, what's new? Where do you want to start with us? And I know you've got a lot of new material to go over. There's been a lot of news lately about calcium that has been making its way into the general press. Start us out. What are your updates?
David, I want the listeners to get a lot out of this, both as to regarding the medical problems in space, but also how this applies to each one of you and how you can take advantage from take advantage of the information that I'm going to provide today. I also want to stress the fact that in the past week, I have had a terrific amount of hits on my website. I have had this website for 12 years, but this is only the second time that I've ever had so many hits as I've had this week. I think probably it's related to the fact that I announced on Facebook perhaps a couple of weeks ago that I was going to be on this program, and I also think that partially it's related to Dragon being hooked and connected with the International Space Station. That's been very, very exciting. And then a lot of information recently provided about the risk of increased calcium intake. Well, I've got about five or six subjects. I'm going to talk first about increased body heat with exercise in microgravity. This is a huge problem, and I haven't discussed this on the program before. Also, the selection of astronaut candidates and the Chinese takenaut, and they call them takenauts or astronauts. Their selection process, which is really unique and exciting, it really knocked me for a loop. And then I want to stress how each one of you must be very cautious when you go to a so-called health store, that you don't take an excess and don't ignore the balance of various minerals. Otherwise, you can lose your life. Just as if you were taking an excess of some narcotic. And then I've got two presentations that I'm going to ahead. I've been invited to an international meeting the end of November in San Antonio. It's a gene therapy international meeting, and I'm going to speak about that a little bit, perhaps if we have time at the end of the program. And then also I've been invited to return to China. I was there in last December at an international cardiology congress, and they have invited me to return there. So when I get back from San Antonio, I have about 5 days, and then I've got to go on to Guangzhou, China, And I'm very, very excited about that. I'm already thinking about going back in 2013. Now, what I'd like to do first is to talk about body heat. And David, if you want to open up the lines, you might want to do this now, or just use your own judgment about that.
Well, let's get a couple of minutes of you talking so people will be able to stay on topic with their questions.
I appreciate it if all of you would go to my website, and on the upper left of the home page, very upper left on the home page, you'll see a note that says, was Irwin's heart rate up to 167 per minute so early in the mission on the lunar surface, 134 degrees centigrade in direct sunlight, related to too much heat? I'd like you all to go to that, and then after you reach it, it's on the home page in the upper left, then scroll down to a comparison of the heart rates of Irwin and Scott on the first excursion of Apollo 15. I have been very, very interested in Apollo 15 for actually since my interest in space research began 20 years ago, because Irwin had a heart attack 21 months after this mission. And so that stimulated my interest. But look at the heart rates now. These are published. These heart rates are published by NASA, and it gives the, I think that I have somewhere the reference, actually. And look at the heart rate of Irwin, and compare the heart rate of Irwin with the heart rate of Scott. And you notice that at the time of 121.30, Irwin's heart rate goes up to 167, estimated about 167, whereas Scott's heart rate is only 128. Now, this is a significant discrepancy. They're both doing exactly the same thing. They're both configuring, at this particular time, the lunar module. In other words, they're putting it together. They got it off the... they're putting together, I'm sorry, the lunar buggy that they took off the off of the lunar module. So they're putting this lunar buggy together. They're both doing exactly the same thing. And one... and Irwin, however, has a heart rate that is at a very dangerous level. And not infrequently during a spacewalk, astronauts will, and also the Russians, have heart rates all the way up to 170. Now, in this particular case, I don't have an explanation as to why it's necessarily that high. It may not be that high on many spacewalks. But this particular one is exciting because my first subject is heat. And any time the heart rate is above 85% of one's maximum heart rate, there is the risk of sudden death from a condition that we call ventricular fibrillation. And that can occur with sudden death within a few seconds. Now, it depends upon one's age. Irwin was 41 at the time that he was on the moon. You're looking at the heart rate of Irwin on the moon, and Irwin's heart rate at age 41, his maximum heart rate would have been about 180. So here's a heart rate of 167, which is well above 85% of his maximum heart rate. And any time you reach a heart rate above 85%, of one's maximum, then there is the risk of sudden death from ventricular fibrillation. So Irwin very easily could have died while he was on the moon on Apollo 15. Now notice that Scott's was only 130. Now one explanation, there may be many explanations, but one explanation is the fact that both of them were exposed to heat in training in Florida before they left for the moon, and they trained in, Irwin describes in his autobiography, intense summer heat. And with intense summer heat, there is a predisposition for a magnesium deficiency, and all of my work in the last 20 years, most of my work in the last 20 years, has been involved with this vitally important mineral, magnesium. So with intense exposure to intense heat, there is loss of magnesium in the sweat, and also the lower the magnesium, the higher the adrenaline, and the higher the adrenaline, the greater loss of magnesium in the kidneys. So it's very possible that Irwin's heart rate was so much higher than Scott's because Irwin's magnesium levels might have been lower. And I'm just guessing, because obviously no one could possibly know what the magnesium levels were in two people on the moon. But I'm postulating that that's so. The lower the magnesium, the higher the adrenaline. The higher the adrenaline, the lower the magnesium. And this elevation of adrenaline in space is a very, very important problem, because the levels of adrenaline in space are about twice as high as the adrenaline levels on Earth when one is supine or lying down. And this is potentially dangerous because the blood vessels can be damaged. One can have a stroke. It is conducive to oxidative stress. These vicious cycles can go on and on until the cycle is broken by perhaps giving magnesium. Now, introduces the next subject.
Hold on. Let me just announce that I've opened the phone lines up, listeners, and if you do want to call, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Go ahead, Bill.
All right. Now, about 10 years ago, since I was so fascinated with Irwin, I went out to interview Irwin's widow. Irwin died after his 21 months after Apollo 15. He had a heart attack. Then he had three subsequent heart attacks and died in 1991. And about the year 2000, I went out to interview Mary Irwin. She lived in Colorado Springs at that time. And I told her I was so fascinated about Irwin, I just had to go out to Colorado Springs to talk to her. And she told me, and if you look at the next entry, I think if you just click on the where it said it's continued from the main page, you'll see that I've written that Jim's cooling system was working in his suit, but he did not select enough cooling temperature for the suit. He said he wished he had selected a little cooler temperature, but then Jim always liked the heat and the direct sunshine. Now, that's a personal communication from Irwin's widow. And in Irwin's autobiography, he describes very heavy perspiration while working on the lunar surface. After the first excursion, there were three of them, both Irwin and Scott took their gloves off, and the perspiration just poured off. Keep in mind that there is no air on the moon, but one can check the temperature by just putting a thermometer on any object on the moon. And when one does this, the temperature at noon on the moon is 250 degrees Fahrenheit. And Irwin in his autobiography states that even when Irwin and Scott were in their underwear, the sweat was just pouring out. Well, so with this, the magnesium was pouring out with it, and this is potentially a big problem, and it involves measures it brings up the whole problem of involving measures to prevent this from occurring. Now, the next thing that and I'll get into that a little bit later, the next thing that I would like all of you to do is look at the reservoir. If you would look at the list of articles that I have, the list of articles, and scroll down to an editorial that I wrote called The Reservoir, it was published in 2003. There are a lot of papers of mine, but if you just scroll down to 2003 and look for The Reservoir, I mention this because I want I want all of you to get some idea about space medicine. It's extremely complicated, but this editorial that I wrote that was published in Space Flight magazine, it's not a peer-reviewed paper, but it's a paper, an editorial that is written for the layman. And after the show is over or sometime in the future, I would highly recommend it. I got 292 hits in the last 6 days just on the Reservoir alone. So it's very, very popular. Now, the next thing that I'd like you to look at, and bear with me, is if you would go on the home page and scroll down to the submarine and click on the submarine. It's right on the home page and right in the center. I don't see how you can miss it. Just scroll down slowly and you'll get to the submarine. And when you get to the submarine, keep in mind the fact that each one of you, each one of us, has 60,000 miles of capillaries in our bodies. And what I have been interested in is the vulnerability of the lining of the blood vessels. And the lining of the blood vessels would cover, in each one of us, 7 tennis courts. So it's extremely vulnerable to injuries. And the reason that I want you to look at it is because, I think a couple of times on previous programs, I think this is a nice time I've been on or something like that, I want you each to understand something about oxidative stress. I don't think that any educated person today can really say that he or she is educated without knowing something about oxidative stress. You see the term oxidative stress all the time and antioxidants, and most of you don't really know what it means. If you would look at imagine that a submarine is traveling through each one of you through those 60,000 miles of blood vessels. And I put there the cardiovascular complications of oxidative stress and prevention with spaceflight and on Earth, the constant battle. And you must understand something about this, because otherwise you won't understand the medical problems that we have with spaceflight, and you won't understand how the aging process exists, which I talked about last time, and you won't understand the importance of having the proper balance as you go through life. And I'll talk about that a little bit later. Look at the submarine and notice that each one of those dots is an electron. And notice that when you, on the left, you'll notice that the electrons are in pairs. And then notice that as you go to the right, you have one electron, a poor little orphan electron, all by itself. And imagine that this electron is not happy with that situation, and a single unpaired electron has a strong affinity for hydrogen ions. It breaks hydrogen bonds, and therefore, since DNA contains hydrogen bonds, the DNA is in jeopardy. And if the DNA is in jeopardy, then genes are in jeopardy, because the genes consist of proteins, and those genes would be in jeopardy because of oxidative stress. And keep in mind, the other points that I've made are that on the left, you've got a submarine which carries torpedoes, and for the protection against those torpedoes, you've got depth charges, which obviously are there to protect. And I've listed the torpedoes, and I don't want to go through all of them. But just notice as you scroll down, the one that I have worked with in the last 20 years as far as research is concerned is low magnesium. That low magnesium, if you have a low magnesium, have potentially a health problem which might cause sudden death or shorten your life. Also notice that there is excessive calcium as a torpedo, and I'm going to talk about that because this is a red hot issue, and so keep that in mind. And then on the depth charges, the protection against these oxidants, I put water first because water contains hydrogen and life cannot exist without water. I put magnesium second. It's a fantastic antioxidant. And although a lot of people don't consider insulin as an antioxidant, it truly is an antioxidant because insulin is necessary for the synthesis of a protein which keeps iron out of harm's way. Now, if you look at the bottom of the drawing that I have, you'll see that if you have a decreased magnesium, there is in turn an excessive. Get my glasses. If you have a decrease in magnesium, you have an increase in unbound or what we call free iron, and this in turn causes oxidative stress. Now, too much iron is deadly. I have a friend in where I live in Charlottesville who had some unusual type of blood, and he was giving blood five times a year. And he said, well, I'm not concerned about it. I'm taking iron. So I said, listen, I said, you're making a terrible mistake by taking iron. It's a gift from heaven to lose blood. And this is the advantage that females have, although most women who go through menstruation won't agree with me. Males have no physiological way of losing iron, whereas females with menstruation lose 30 to 50 cc's of blood every month, and with it, they lose iron. Also, with sweating, there's a loss of iron, and that really provides an advantage. Males who sweat with running, for example, that's really the only way that they can lose iron is by sweating. So it's not all bad, but we'll talk about that. All right, let's go on to the problems in space now. I mentioned the fact that adrenal levels are twice as high in microgravity as they are in the supine position on Earth, and one should keep that in mind. I mentioned about the fact that an important fact is that that with a decrease in water, there is an increase in the core body temperature, and that in turn increases adrenaline. There's a good way to study that in space, and this is a real problem. One way of studying this in space is to have astronauts swallow a thermometer, and then it comes out of the stool a couple days later, but this is an excellent way of studying the core temperature. Now, we've known that with exercise in space, and it's been known for really quite a number of years. Here's a paper that I have in front of me in 1998, that the body temperature and thermoregulation is a significant problem. And this particular article addresses the fact that after 115 days, the body temperature is increased to a significantly greater level than if one were exercising on Earth. And this is related to several factors. First of all, there's a shift of fluid to the upper part of the body, and in order to get rid of body heat, there are a couple of ways of doing this. One is to increase the amount of circulation to the capillaries underneath the skin, and then by convection, one loses body heat. So suppose the circulation is impaired throughout the body, and this certainly can occur in space, then in turn, the circulation of the capillaries underneath the skin are going to be inadequate, and one is going to not have adequate release of heat through convection. Another problem is in space that there is an increase in fluid within very, very short time of being in microgravity to the upper part of the body. Well, if there's an increase in fluid to the upper part of the body, then there is a reduction in the amount of fluid in the extremities. And if there's a reduction in fluid in the extremities, lower extremities in the legs, then that in turn would you would lose an avenue of loss of body heat in that way. And then also with sweating and evaporation of sweating, that is another way of cooling off the body. And so obviously in a humid environment, that's why all of us suffer. I've been very interested in Dr. Beller's study that goes all the way back to 1974. Dr. Beller right now lives in Charlottesville, where I am, and was head of the Department of Cardiology, very fine cardiologist. And he, in 1974, published an article about the loss of magnesium in the sweat during work in the heat. And we've communicated a couple times, and the other reason why there's a loss of magnesium in the heat is because the lower the magnesium, the higher not only the adrenaline levels are, but the higher a vessel constrictor, and I won't mention the word because some of you will perhaps not want to listen any longer with long medical terms. But anyhow, the bottom line is that not only is there a loss of magnesium with sweat, but there's a loss of magnesium in the kidneys with exposure to heat. And this is a significant problem in all of us, but it's a major problem in space, and I don't have all the answers, nor does anyone else. One thing that we might do in space is to wear a cooling vest before one starts exercising in space, and then wearing this cooler vest during exercise. I might stop right now if anybody has any questions. If not, we'll go on.
Well, no, keep going. I'll bring them in when they come in. I think people are probably still listening to hear what you have to say.
All right.
And again, listeners, let me give out the number one more time. It's toll-free 1-866-687-7223. And email, of course, is drspace@thespaceshow.com. And the line is open. And we are taking in email questions, so if you do want to communicate with us, go ahead, and I'll bring them up to Dr. Rowe as soon as I hear from you. Go ahead, Bill.
The other thing, here's a study. I've got all these papers in front of me because I can't keep this all in my head. Here's a paper that was done in Israel, and it's really a classic paper, about the fact that with a loss of magnesium, there's an adverse effect on the hypothalamus, which is the temperature-regulating system of the body in the brain, and that plays a role also because it's vitally important to make all these connections, and the hypothalamus in the brain serves that function. A major problem that we have in space, and which is a major problem contributing to this heat increase in heat with exercise, is the fact that the plasma volume is diminished. We know that there's about a 10% reduction in plasma volume and in space. It occurs within a very, very short time, within a few days. It's a major problem. There really isn't a real good way at this time to correct the problem other than giving an astronaut a plasma volume substitute.
Why is it a problem to lose some of your plasma?
Well, I'm just about to,
okay.
about to mention it. With a loss of plasma, one of the problems is that insulin resistance can occur. If the cells in the body don't have an adequate amount of water in the cells, this causes insulin resistance. All of you, or most of you, are aware of the extremely dangerous situation that teenagers now, young teenagers with obesity, are developing insulin resistance. Insulin doesn't work. And it's in young people who are obese. And this is a very, very dangerous situation. And it's a worldwide situation. Insulin, I've listed it as one of the antioxidants. It's a marvelous antioxidant because it's necessary to for the synthesis of a protein which keeps iron out of harm's way. I tried to explain that too much iron, which is not bound to this protein, and I won't, I'll use the term is transferrin. If there isn't enough transferrin or enough of this particular protein, then iron, just like a criminal can cause all sorts of trouble in the city, well, too much free iron can do the same thing in a body. So if there's a water deficit, there are all sorts of bad things that happen, but one of them is an interesting one is that it causes insulin resistance. Now, why is the plasma volume diminished? It's always diminished, always, 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 in space at least 10%. One of the reasons is because the thirst mechanism is lousy in space. God knows why, but it is. And you can tell astronauts to drink more water, but if they're not thirsty, they're not going to comply as well as they would if they had this God-given reflex. There is a water deficit because of decreased thirst. There's also a water deficit. There's a plasma volume deficit because the plasma leaks out. Carolyn Leach has made a tremendous contribution to space, and in her book that was published about 1998, she has emphasized this loss of plasma and has emphasized the fact that she believes that the loss of plasma down to about 10%, a major factor, is the fact that the lining of the blood vessels is damaged. And with damage to the lining of the blood vessels, there is leaking of this plasma. It's interesting. If you take a rat, and remember, we share 80-85% of the same genes as a rat. If you take a rat and tie a weight to that rat, which is about 3% of the body weight of that rat, and throw the rat, the poor rat, in the water, and force that rat to swim after just 4 hours with that weight of 3% of his body weight, you will damage the lining of the blood vessels. And guess what? If you take a rat and put that rat in microgravity in space, after 12 days, you will see the identical changes in the lining of the blood vessels. And all of you people who feel that we should have gone to Mars at 4:30 yesterday afternoon or 4:45, just address that one issue alone. And there are thousands of other problems. That's just one of them. All right.
You do have a couple of email questions.
All right.
This is one from Jefferson in Los Angeles. And he says, this is all very interesting, but I hear NASA people talk about human factors all the time and the major challenges, and they never talk about any of this. Do they not know what you're talking about? Do they purposely stay superficial, or do they possibly disagree with you?
Well, every time I'm on this program, I think it's the eighth or ninth time I get the same question,
because people never hear it, Bill.
I can't help it. Listen, it's out there. Some of it is just downright political. Some of it is political. I have, for example, ever since I published an article about the case for an all-female crew to Mars, I don't remember how many years, I think it was 2004, I have had one hell of a time getting published in a space-related journal since 2004. Now, you might say, well, this Dr. Rowe is just paranoid. Well, I'm getting published elsewhere, but I, for example, one journal, and I won't mention these names, I sent a paper which I thought was gorgeous, and I never even got a email response that I had even sent it. I sent three subsequent emails over a week period of time, and they didn't ever even acknowledge that I'd sent it. I'll tell you another thing, another situation. When I found out that Irwin came back from the moon with a blood pressure, extraordinary blood pressure that I mentioned before, of over 225 over 125 in just 3 minutes, on a bicycle the day after he returned from Apollo 15, and I got this through the Freedom of Information Act. I wrote a paper about that, and I sent it to another journal, and again, I won't mention it, and within 48 hours, that paper was rejected. And I have been told over and over that there's no political aspect to this particular journal, and it just goes in one ear and out the other. Those are just two examples. It's out there. Keep in mind also there are 1 to 2 million journals, 1 to 2 million papers with PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D, and I think some of these people either are not reading the literature and not keeping up, or it's just denial. And again, I think some of it's political, but not all of it. Some of it is just sheer ignorance. That's all. I have no difficulty, no real difficulty, with a lot of competition getting published, but I myself can't get published more recently in some of these journals. Well, there are exceptions, but that's basically it. And yet, when I send an abstract and it goes through peer review related to space, it goes right through. I'm not bragging, but I got invited to present a paper in China last year at the International Cardiology Congress about space, and they want me to come back this year, and I can't wait to go back. All I can tell you is that I'm getting published, but I'm not getting published in space journals. So I don't know if I've answered the question or not, but I can't help it. All I can tell you is that I've spent the last 20 years of my life, and it's been very, very exciting investigating what I'm doing, and I don't really care. I've got a strong enough self-image that I don't care. Now, I think that what I'd like to do now, if there are no other, other questions, is go on to another subject.
Go ahead and go. And again, listeners, do us a favor and don't wait until the show's about to end before you pick up the phone and call, which is what you've been doing lately. So if you do want to call us when we have ample time to talk to you. Again, 866-687-7223. Okay, go ahead.
The next subject is about China. And when I went, I might tell you this first, when I went to China last December, and I was invited to by the Chinese, I had a certain amount of guilt. I love my country, and I thought to myself, am I being a traitor to go over to China and give information? Well, so anyhow, I have a friend who is with NASA, high up in NASA, and he just said, go for it and forget what people might say. Well, anyhow, first of all, nothing that I present is ever classified. I don't have any access to classified information anyhow. Well, this is a very, very exciting publication came out in the China Daily, and I saw it on the Internet, and I wasn't going to go back on the space show, but I saw this. It came out in May of 2012, and it knocked me for a loop. It involves what the Chinese do in their process of selecting female astronauts. They call them takenauts. And just let me go through this. It really is mind-boggling. Let's put it this way. I don't know whether Paul Deer is listening. Paul Deer is a senior investigator at the MRC laboratory in Cambridge, England, and they're working on the genome, and there are 9 Nobel laureates that Paul worked with, and Paul's IQ is up on the ceiling, and for him even to waste time communicating with me, it's a real ego trip. Well, anyhow, Paul and I have discussed some of these things. The idea is this. Now there is the availability of evaluating in each one of us the probably somewhere close to 24,000 genes. And the present cost is about $2,000, something around that figure. Well, maybe in 5 years from now, it'll be down to $500. I don't know, and I have the slightest idea. But the idea is this. If you want to make a selection of astronauts, you can't possibly take 5,000 of them and run a genome on 5,000 people, the cost and the logistics would be astronomical. Well, the Chinese, for example, have a very, very clever selective process that I have never read about, and it's really exciting. Now, they're talking about making a selection of young taconauts who are in their early 30s, under the age of 35, and we're just talking about females now. They want these female candidates to be married. They must have given birth, and they must have given birth naturally. So right away you know that they want somebody who can tolerate pain. And they must not have any scars. Now, that was a new one to me. They must not have any scars. Why? Because scars bleed in space. I didn't know it. But apparently scars bleed in space. If they've published it, it must be so.
You mean a healed scar? A scar already healed, maybe
healed
several
scar.
Years old?
They don't want a candidate with any scars, period, any scars. Now, let me go on. I wrote a letter to the editor about this in Spaceflight Magazine, and I just sent it off about a month ago because I'm really excited about this. It's not only the fact that they say, and I don't see any, I don't know of anything published about it in peer-reviewed articles, but if they say it, it must be so. It's not only the fact that scars might bleed in space, and if they do, as we're talking about an old scar, God knows any scar, I've come to the conclusion that there may be another reason. If you've got an we don't know what causes acute appendicitis, but there's almost certainly there must be an infectious element to it. If you have an appendectomy scar, perhaps at that particular time, you were more vulnerable about getting infection. I don't know, but maybe that's so. If you have a gallbladder scar, certainly that could be due to a metabolic problem. So if you don't have any scars, maybe it means that you're less susceptible to infection and less susceptible to metabolic problems. Well, that might be another reason, and perhaps it's a stretch, but if I have to think through the thing, that's where I would go. Now, the next asset is that they want females with dry skin. Now, we're not talking about somebody who has pathological dryness of the skin. What they're saying is they want females who perspire less than the average. Now, that has two advantages. Number one, if one perspires a lot, then there's going to be an odor because odors occur from perspiration plus bacteria. If there's no bacteria, probably there's not going to be any odor. But that combination causes it, and obviously in a tight compartment, let's say in the lunar module, that may be a problem, and you can't run very far when you're on the moon. So that's a problem, but it also suggests that they don't have to perspire as much, and if they don't, if these particular females who have relatively dry skin don't have to perspire as much, to me it suggests the fact that they have a better blood flow to the periphery, therefore they have better capillary function at the periphery, and therefore they can bring body heat from the core up to the periphery, and they don't have to perspire as much. In other words, perspiration is important, but it would be real nice if you could tolerate heat and control it and cool your body without having to perspire at all, because when you perspire, you become dehydrated. And I just got through telling you a few minutes ago that with a reduction in the water in the cells, that increases insulin resistance. So that's very, very interesting to me. Another criteria, they must have perfect teeth, no cavities. Well, obviously, and they don't want anybody who has had any fillings. Now, It's not only the fact that someone may get into trouble in space with required emergency dental care, but going hand in hand with problems with teeth, guess what? Going hand in hand with this are problems of the bone. And the two are tied up, and fluoride, for example, controls not only cavities to a certain extent, it reduces the problem of cavities, but also reduces problems of bones. So you can, if you just go down the line, one step after another, this is really a marvelous way of screening people before you end up doing a genome study. Let me tell you, I love my country, but we sure made some mistakes. For example, Irwin, who had all this trouble, I told you he had a heart attack 21 months after Apollo 15. Not only that, I've told you, I've mentioned this on previous programs, that when he was transferring from the lunar module back to the command module to go back home, he had a heart rhythm disturbance and lost consciousness for about 30 seconds. And how many people know this? And I've already mentioned the fact that his blood pressure was elevated. And Irwin really should never have been selected to go to the moon in the first place, because 1 month before Apollo 15, his blood pressure at rest was 145 over 110. Now, even back in the 70s, when the Apollo missions were, I think Apollo 15 was about 1970 or 1971, even then we knew that 145 over 110 ain't no good. So he never should have been selected in the first place. He was a terrible candidate because with high blood pressure, there's blood vessel disease. The other thing that I want to mention is the fact that females have another advantage as far as sweating is concerned, that females perspire less than males, and therefore if females perspire less than males, there is less risk of losing magnesium through the sweat. The other problem is that if one has scars, therefore they might be more they might have a greater predisposition for problems in space. A wound healing is certainly impaired in space. Everything that you possibly could imagine that might happen will happen in space. How are we going to operate on somebody in space? The person who called, if you would just think of all these things that I've mentioned to you already, I haven't even scratched the surface about all the problems we have in space. But how are you going to operate on somebody when wound healing is impaired? I've talked on this program about the fact that we can't use pharmaceuticals in space because eventually for a long mission because there's impairment in liver and kidney function, and therefore we won't be able to metabolize or excrete the pharmaceutical. I've also mentioned the fact in the past that there's no way, because of invariable malabsorption in space, in other words, the gastrointestinal tract does not function properly, whatever pharmaceutical is given has to be given subcutaneously, and I've mentioned this at least two or three times on previous programs, there is no way to administer subcutaneous pharmaceuticals. On a practical basis, you can't possibly give an astronaut a subcutaneous injection every 4 hours for a round trip to Mars of 22 months, and we have no subcutaneous device which can be replenished, none available at this time. So this person who called in, these are just some of the problems we have, and I can't help it if somebody hasn't published all this. It's there, and it is published. And there are a lot of brilliant people who have published all these things, but some of the doctors who are associated with the whole program, they're just not keeping up with the literature. It's out there. The Russian literature, the American literature, the Chinese literature, the French, it's all out there. It's just a matter of getting it. It's very difficult to keep up, but since these since we're talking about doctors who have a specialty, if that's their life's work as in space medicine, they've got to know about this.
Well, here's an... Well, I was going to give you an email, but here's a phone call for you. Hold on. Good afternoon, caller. Who are you, please?
This is John in Atlanta.
Hi, John. Haven't heard from you in a while. How you been?
Okay, on vacation.
Lucky you. Did you go any place fun?
Back to Missouri.
Not to the moon, huh?
Nope.
Go ahead with...
friends and relatives.
Go ahead with Dr. Rowe.
Yeah, well, do you think on this Irwin thing that that perhaps is what happened to him on the moon had something to do with his later heart condition?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I can't tell you for sure. There's no way. Medicine is complicated. There's no way to prove what we call a cause and effect relationship. It might not have had anything to do with his heart attack 21 months later, because coronary artery disease is extremely common anyhow. I can't possibly tell you that his 2 weeks in the moon had anything at all to do with his heart attack 21 months later, nor could anyone else. But all I can tell you is this, that, number one, he was a male. We know that the cardiovascular mortality rate is 6 times higher in males than females under the age of 35. That is well documented. Therefore, it makes no sense to even send any male up for a prolonged mission in space. I'm not talking about a 2-week lunar mission, but I'm talking about going to Mars. It makes no sense to send males up for a minimum of 22 months for a round trip to Mars and then waiting for Mars and the Earth to be aligned closely enough for a return trip. It's at least 22 months. It makes absolutely no sense to send a male in the first place. I don't know if I've answered your question, but whether I can sit here or stand here and tell you that there's a cause and effect relationship, absolutely not. Science is, some of it is, some of it must be, we must be very, very cautious. I think one of the first ingredients of science and coming up with an hypothesis or coming up with an answer is caution.
Yeah. Well, what about this magnesium loss you keep focusing on? Would it be possible to mitigate this by putting increased magnesium in the foods that they eat up there or something?
It's not enough. Is your name John?
Yes, John? Yes, it is John.
Uh-huh. John, it's not enough. The problem is that Abidon, A-M-I-D-O-N, in 1991 published a marvelous article about the fact that there is invariably malabsorption in space. Malabsorption meaning that there's impairment in absorption of the gastrointestinal tract, the gastrointestinal in space. In microgravity, the gastrointestinal tract does not function. And when you read that article, and I've got it, somebody wants it, I've got the reference, but I can't remember it off the top of my head. He has very, very complicated formulas to show why the gastrointestinal tract doesn't function and why there's impairment in absorption. So whatever magnesium you give has to be given subcutaneously. It can't be given by mouth. Well, obviously, you're going to eat. You're going to do the best you can. You're going to take medications by mouth and do the best you can. But you have to keep in mind that with invariable malabsorption, you can't depend upon taking magnesium tablets, for example, because with malabsorption, they may not be absorbed adequately.
Hmm. And even even if it was actually just, if they just enriched the food itself
Well, I mean, that's going to help. I mean, a high magnesium diet, I'll just rattle them off right now. I eat a high magnesium diet. Dark leafy vegetables, legumes, which are beans, nuts, an excellent source, whole grains. What else? Those are the major ones. I'm trying to think. Dried fruit. So those are the five. Those are all very high in magnesium. I try to do this every day, but I have no problem because I'm not on the moon.
Yeah. That's the other thing. I guess the question is, what level of gravity? I mean, if we actually had, let's say, a large space station or something where we actually could maintain Earth normal type gravity with centrifugal effects, and it was large enough that the Coriolis effects weren't too disturbing, that presumably this problem would go away then, you think?
Well, are you saying could we duplicate exactly one G? If, and I've addressed this in previous times that I've been on the space show, if we can address, duplicate exactly, and it's got to be exactly one G, and eliminate microgravity, that will solve the problem en route to Mars or en route to an asteroid or en route and then return from any one of these places. The problem that I have argued with and I have discussed with Paul Deer from England is the fact that how are we going to explore going out on some type of device, going 50 miles or 100 miles on Mars, for example? How are we going to go from point A to point B? Or how are we going to dig tunnels? Or how are we going to build shelters without the astronauts being exposed to microgravity during that particular period of time and then putting the cardiovascular system in jeopardy? If very well it's possible that 20, 30, 40, 50, 100 years from now, we will be able to have some device which will duplicate exactly 1G while one is doing these various activities. But right now, there is nothing available. And the body, the blood vessels don't have eyes. The heart doesn't have eyes. The heart and blood vessels, all they know is the jeopardy that they are being placed into with high adrenaline, low magnesium, vicious cycles of all sorts.
Yeah. Well, the question is, you know, we talk about 1G specific, and of course the moon is a sixth of a G, but I guess the question is how much below
1G you go before. Nope, John, I have to interrupt you. Every time I go on this program, I get the same question, and God love you, I think it's a great question. It ain't going to work. It must be exactly 1G. The body may not react adversely in 10 days or 2 weeks. It may not react adversely that one can detect with even sophisticated instrumentation. But eventually, the body will not withstand that situation. And I have, every time I'm on this program, I get the same question. It has to be exactly 1G. Let me say, I'm not alone in this. There is a really well-known, very, very prominent flight surgeon who has just left NASA within the last month or so, and he and I have discussed this by email, and he agrees with me and has said the same thing for God knows how long, that 1G is the rule. It's got to be exactly 1G. John, I'm sorry, that's the way it is.
Are you aware that there's now a, I'm going to call it a real project on the table to finance and put a variable gravity research station in sync orbit around the space station to do the long-term studies to see if what you're saying is really correct?
Well, I think it's a waste of money. It'll go down a rat hole. If somebody wants to spend...
Well, I don't know that they'll fund it, but that's neither here nor there.
Wants to spend X amount of money and try it at 4/5 gravity or 1.3 gravity.
They want to start with the moon.
Or start... wherever they go, that money's going to go down a rat hole. The body just won't stand for it, and I would just bet anything on it if I hadn't had the money. It just isn't going to work. I just feel certain about it. I just got through saying that you can't be dogmatic about anything. I can certainly be dogmatic about this. And if anybody wants to debate me, I would love to.
Okay. Let me throw something else at you, and John, stay on the phone. When I did the Space Show Classroom program about a month ago with Dr. Jurist and Dr. Adrian LeBlanc, who's the PI of the bone loss bisphosphonate study that is now concluding at NASA, and also Dr. Tom Lang at UCSF, I asked a question to these guys, do you think artificial gravity will work even if it's at 1G? And there's a long pause, and I think it was Dr. LeBlanc, I guess y'all can listen to the show to see if it was him or Dr. Lang, but I think it was Adrian, and he said, doubtful that artificial gravity will do it. It's not going to be the same as 1G on Earth, and there are some indicators right now that artificial gravity won't make the cut. So, you know, nobody wants to agree with him, and he said it was, you know, beyond preliminary, so you can guess what that means. But maybe artificial gravity at 1G doesn't work.
Well,
you can hear him say that. I'm not making it up.
It has to be exactly 1G. If you can duplicate exactly 1G 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, I think that's fine. That'll work.
Well, I'm just repeating what he said.
I don't know why it won't.
Is that because of Coriolis effects?
I don't know. I suspect it's because there are some subtle differences between natural gravity and artificial gravity that play a role in this, and they're starting to pick up some of the indicators of this, but it's so inconclusive. He did respond to my question, fortunately, but, you know, you can't go bet money on the answer. That's how I'd say it.
If you use the word exactly, I don't see what the problem is. If you can duplicate exactly 1G, I don't see what the problem is.
Well, you may be able to do 1G, but there might be subtle differences between artificial and natural gravity.
Well, because you're using a centrifuge, and I don't know about this. Those are physics.
Well, they're using a tether or a centrifuge.
Yeah, I don't see that's beyond my expertise.
So, go ahead, John.
Well, I mean, obviously the differences that would be the fact that if it's a, you know, relatively small device, obviously, you would have variations in, I mean, you know, like the curvature, you know, it'd vary, it'd be kind of a different layout than it'd be on Earth, which, and so forth, and you have Coriolis effects. I think if you make it large enough, that may be the problem, the weight limitation or a tether, I would think then it would be almost the same. You know.
Well, I think you're getting into problems of physics, and I can't, that's beyond my expertise. I'm sorry, I can't answer, I can't go any further.
Yeah, I got you.
All right, listen, if there aren't any questions, I'm going to go on.
Well, no, we're actually going to take...
pretty well covered my stuff.
Thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Bill, we're halfway or so, let's take a three-minute break, okay?
Okay.
And I've got more emails, but I'm hoping they'll quit emailing and use the darn phone. So, listeners, back in 3 minutes with Dr. Bill Rowe. Don't go anyplace.
This is with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a space-faring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of the Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. This is part two of our Sunday Space Show. Our guest today, Dr. Bill Rowe, and we're talking about a broad range of issues you won't hear talked about any other place than on the Space Show and with Dr. Rowe regarding human factors for space. Bill, welcome back to part two. Listeners, the toll-free line is available, 1-866-672-5787. 687-7223. I know you want to lead us off with some of the newer information on calcium.
David, I mentioned at the beginning that I want the listeners to learn something, a take-home message, not only for space, but what each one of the listeners can do to prolong their own lives. Now, there's a red-hot issue which just recently has been published about the problems with calcium. I want to emphasize that be very careful, all of you, when you go into a so-called health store, that you know what you're doing. You can't just, if calcium is good, you can't just, if you're supposed to take 3 tablets a day, you can't just say, well, I'm going to, since I'm worried about osteoporosis, loss of mineral content in my bone, why don't I just take 6 tablets a day? The body doesn't work like this, and it's not going to stand for it, and you're going to pay for it. Now, recently, there was a publication in the, I first saw it on the internet, called the AMA, that's the American Medical Association, Morning Rounds. And I didn't know about it, but they were quoting this American Medical Association article, was quoting a German study which showed that an excess amount of calcium can, if one takes an excess amount of calcium, that may increase the risk of a heart attack and a stroke. And this is a very large study which was published recently and of 24,000 subjects. This is what we want to do in medicine. Remember, in space, we've only had 500 people who've ever been up in space, so we're very, very limited. It may take us 50 or 100 years to accomplish enough research in microgravity to accomplish what one could do on Earth in perhaps a couple of years. So that's the problem. So this is a huge study, a very large study. I shouldn't use the word huge, but it's a study of 24,000 subjects between the ages of 35 and 64. And this study determined that if one has an excess of calcium by ingesting calcium supplements, that there is an increased risk of heart attacks, we call myocardial infarctions and stroke, and also strokes. But if one has an increase in calcium in the food, that one has a reduction in the risk and the incidence of heart attack. Now, a lot of people have poo-pooed the article, criticized it, because that, they said, doesn't make any sense. How could you increase the calcium by tablets and have an increased risk to the body of the circulation, and yet if you put it in the food, this won't occur? Well, I think there's a very, very simple answer. Now, I'm just guessing, because there isn't, so far, obviously, if it's just been published recently, there isn't going to be a rebuttal to this at this point. But the answer might very well be, and I've already addressed this with a letter to the editor, which I sent to Spaceflight Magazine about a month ago, the answer might be very simple, that when you ingest an increased amount of calcium in the food, you also ingest with it a certain amount of magnesium in certain foods, and that leads to what we call a calcium-magnesium ratio. And if that calcium-magnesium ratio, the intake of calcium and the intake of magnesium and the ratio between the two, if that ratio is favorable, then one might have less risk of having cardiovascular disease. Whereas if you take just pure calcium alone, and we're not mentioning magnesium, then that increased calcium may cause one to lose one's life. Now, that is a very, very interesting concept, and there's nothing new there really is nothing new about the whole idea of the calcium-magnesium ratio. There's nothing new about it. The thing that's new is the fact that finally, after decades and decades and decades, somebody has had the insight to do a large epidemiological study and come up with something which is food for thought. Now, as always, there is controversy, just the way I've stirred up controversy today, and that's not all bad. That's the way we all learn. But the point is this. I wrote a letter to the editor, and if you would scroll down, go to my list of articles and scroll down to 2006, and a letter to the editor that I published in American Journal of Cardiology that I titled The Calcium-Magnesium Ratio Intake and Cardiovascular Risk. It's 2006. I'll wait a minute while all of you find it. You can't really read it while I'm talking to you or understand what I've said and why you're listening, but keep in mind that it is written for physicians and not for the layman, this particular one. But I think that you'll get the gist of it if you try to go through it, or you can ask your physician about it. Now, I haven't, that little letter to the editor that I wrote, that isn't any breakthrough at all. It really just summarizes what investigators have known for years. All the way back in the 60s, Mildred Seelig, who was my mentor for about 15 years and was one of the world's leading authorities on magnesium, Mildred Seelig argued and published the fact that excessive calcium without an adequate amount of magnesium can shorten one's life because of multiple problems, but primarily cardiovascular disease. And then Mildred didn't, however, recommend what that intake of calcium as opposed to magnesium should be. But in the 70s, it was published in the 70s that in Finland has the, in the 70s, not now, but in the 70s, Finland had the highest incidence of cardiovascular mortality in the world, in Finland. And guess what? Their intake of calcium in relationship to magnesium was 4-1, four units of calcium for every one unit of magnesium. And then in the 80s, Dr. Durlach, D-U-R-L-A-C-H, from France, published the fact that he recommended that everyone not ingest more than a 2-1 ratio between calcium and magnesium. And this is vitally important. That was in the 80s, and that has been pushed ever since. And I take no calcium whatsoever. If my wife takes calcium, I'm going to leave her. She's sitting right in the living room right now. And am I worried about my wife having a fractured hip? Am I worried about my having one? No, because magnesium is also necessary for the bone. And Mildred Seelig, my mentor for 15 years, told me at age 83 she took no calcium. And since Mildred was probably a genius and knew more about calcium than perhaps anybody in the world, that was good enough for me. So I've told all my friends, and I've published the fact that really, well, I haven't published it, but I told all my friends, my relatives, don't take any calcium at all, but try to get enough magnesium, because magnesium is also necessary for the bone. Now, what happens is this.
Just let me interrupt you. You got a caller on hold. So
yeah, go ahead.
You want to take that caller?
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
So I don't know what we're talking about because I don't screen the calls. Hi, caller. Are you still with us, please?
I am.
Go ahead.
Okay. This is Tim from Huntsville.
Okay.
All right. Well, first I want to comment on what he said about partial artificial gravity, partial G gravity research. I would not dismiss it offhand, because even if it does not solve the problems of body bone and muscle deterioration and all the other problems, you at least then have data points where you can say, well, this particular ailment is more sensitive to reductions in gravity than this ailment right here. And then you have multiple data points that you can gauge the level of sensitivity to gravity that the body would have. I also don't know why there would be any particular physical reason why 1G artificial gravity would not have an effect, except for maybe effect by the Coriolis. But even then, you're going to have some partial improvement in the way the human body deals with artificial gravity. I mean, there's nothing physical about the body that loading on the body would have to come from a space-time distortion, which is what gravity is, versus a centrifugal force, which is what artificial gravity would be.
Well, that's a good point, and no one can argue with that. That's a marvelous point. All you're really saying is that it perhaps doesn't make a whole lot of difference how you do it, as long as you do it and duplicate 1G, and nobody would argue with that. And you're talking about the fact that you start off with data points, and that's a marvelous point that you're making. I can't argue with that. That's great.
What else, Tim?
You might not like what I'm about to say, but
that's all right.
I want to take issue with the all-female crews.
Yeah.
That you have now, two issues. One, since even all female crews would be adversely affected by microgravity, that's going to mean that you're going to still have to have artificial gravity for long duration flights, which means that most of your advantages are nullified right at that point, where it doesn't really make a difference whether or not you have an all female crew, an all male crew of smaller than average sized males with about the same height and weight as your average female.
The other
thing is psychological. Most high risk jobs, most occupation that puts people out where they're in cramped or harsh living conditions, men take those because psychologically they're more adept to that than women are.
Well, I tell you, you're missing one of the points. I got through telling you that the cardiovascular mortality rate is six times higher in males than females. I mean, it's six times higher under the age of 35. And therefore, if you're going to, now we have, for the first time, human beings have a choice. We have a choice as to whether we're going to tolerate the testosterone versus the estrogen, and we have a choice as to which ones we're going to send up into space. Since we've got the choice, there is no logical reason, since the cardiovascular mortality rate is six times higher in males than females under the age of 35, there is no logical reason to send somebody on a two-year mission if the mortality rate is that high. The only value of sending males to Mars or to an asteroid or any place else is to provide sperm for colonization. Otherwise, it makes no sense. The other point is this, and I've mentioned this before, and this is well documented. After the age of 30, the lining of the blood vessels does not heal adequately. Does not heal adequately under the age of 30. After the age of 30. Who's one of the, Paul Van Ute from, I think he's from France, is one of the leading authorities on the endothelium, which is lining the blood vessels, and he has published this way back in 1986, that the lining of the blood vessels does not heal adequately after age 30. And I have written a letter to the editor that if we're going to go to Mars, since the endothelium is vulnerable in space, that we've got to be back by age 30. And so I argued that if we're going to go to Mars, we should go by age 27 and be back by age 30. Now, you're assuming that somehow or other, if we go to Mars or if we go to an asteroid, and if we can duplicate exactly 1G, that everything's going to be rosy. But it isn't going to be because of this discrepancy in the cardiovascular system. The problem is that estrogen is an antioxidant, and plus the fact that the iron levels are too high in males, those are two reasons right there. I could go on and on with all sorts of other reasons. That's why I've argued this, that I don't agree with you about your second point. Your first point, I think, is marvelous.
Anything else, Tim?
Well, yeah, there is. Now, you're talking about health problems that are prevalent among men, but women also have health problems of their own. I mean, their osteoporosis pops up far more in women than men. By that logic, you can say that they're going to be more susceptible to bone loss than men.
You're missing the point. You're missing the point. I told you that they have to. I've said that they have to be back by age 30. We're not going to have an increased risk of osteoporosis under the age 30 in females compared to males. You're missing the point. You're talking about postmenopausal females, and I'm talking about females under the age of 30. So I'm very, very sorry, and I don't want to be dogmatic about it, but you're missing the point. The reason you're missing the point partly is because we're both males, and we don't like the idea that females can do anything better than we can. That's part of it. I can't break through it.
That's not the reason why I said those.
Is Betty Rowe, but I happen to be a male. I've been happily married for 55 years plus. That's just the way it is.
Tim, finish it up. I'm getting a lot of emails that people want to use the phone.
Okay, well, that wasn't the reason why I said those things. I didn't say it because, there's some women that can do something better than me, I'm angry about it. That's not why. I wanted to point out that there's pros and cons to everything. And as for picking people on, this particular demographic, I like to point out that people all the time throughout their whole life do things that are unhealthy. Even much more unhealthier than going out into space. I would have a lot of problems with trying to say, well, we need to make sure there are zero health effects whatsoever before we send anyone out to space. I mean, that's the reason why we pick people based on other criteria other than, well, is there going to be a health problem 30 or 40 years down the line? Because we understand that there is. I mean, there's people that go up to Mount Everest.
We have to go on.
We got to move on, Tim. Listeners, I'm sorry, Tim. I can't just keep rehashing it. I've got too many people who want to use the phone lines. It is 1-866-687-7223. And you're welcome to call if you want out there. And, of course, email drspace@thespaceshow.com. Someone else is already calling. Hi, caller. Who are you, please?
Hi, this is John from Montana.
Hi, John. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Bill and David.
Hi, John.
Hey, I haven't heard much talk about the problem of vitamin D associated with calcium absorption and the combined effects with magnesium and calcium. If you go into any health food store to get calcium supplements,
there will be a shortage of vitamin D. There is a shortage of vitamin D in space, and it's very, very important that this vitamin D deficiency in space be corrected. Vitamin D is also necessary for bone, and I'm sure you know that.
Right.
So is magnesium necessary, and so is calcium. And it raises the point that all of us should take vitamin D3 supplement. It is especially in the winter, because in the summer, the sun will provide enough vitamin D, 3, but in the winter it won't. And in space, obviously, there is no exposure, if you're in space. So that's very, very important. I think the jury is out as to what the dose is. I would, from what I can gather, the experts, at least some of the experts that I've read, have instructed one not to take more than 1,000 international units of vitamin D3. And it should be vitamin D3. Remember that vitamin D3 is the only vitamin which is actually synthesized in the body. So that's very, very important. And I, Mildred Seelig was somewhat anxious about one taking too much vitamin D3. Like everything else, you've got to be careful about the dose. It's possible that if you take an excess vitamin D, D3 above 1,000 international units, it might increase calcium overload to the blood vessels and increase calcium deposits in the machinery of the energy producing machinery in the muscle and elsewhere, and you might get into trouble. I want to impress upon you that when you walk into a quote health store, be very, very careful that you know what you're doing. If you walk in there and just take too much calcium or too much of this or too much of that, or if you ignore the balance, you may get in a lot of trouble. And the other problem is that a lot of doctors haven't kept up the literature. In PubMed alone, there are between 1 and 2 million articles. No physician on God's earth, I don't care what specialty they're in, can keep up with the literature. And don't assume. I was in private practice in internal medicine and cardiology for 34 years, and I have that background that many people who are involved in space medicine do not have. And I learned a lot in 34 years in practice, and many, many doctors cannot keep up with literature. I couldn't possibly keep up with it. I tried to read 2 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it was a losing battle. John, I don't know if I've answered your question, but I'm glad you brought up about vitamin D3.
Well, you've answered it partially. The main concern that I had is that people go into health food stores looking for calcium supplements for whatever reasons they choose to. They're going to be almost always getting a vitamin D supplement along with it. And if you take multivitamins, they do the same thing. Almost all of them will have like 400 international units of vitamin D.
Well, I just would not do that. I'm sure that... That I don't think that's a good idea. What I would do is separate the out.
Exactly.
Get pure calcium, get pure D3, get pure magnesium, and don't have anything that's a mixture because you're going to get all screwed up.
That was the fundamental motivation I had for calling in on that. And the other thing with respect to Tim's call about artificial gravity and the like, I have it... more or less, my concept is that at rotation rates of less than perhaps a revolution a minute, centripetal acceleration could work out, but that implies a pretty large radius cabin or tether system in order to approach 1G. So and the other trade-offs are still in play. For example, the synergistic effects between radiation and bone turnover rates, the effects on osteoprogenesis
bone what?
And so on are still there.
Bone what?
Bone turnover rates.
Turnover rate. All right.
Yeah, because of the synergistic effects of cosmic radiation on the inhibition of differentiation of various bone cells. And we've talked about that on the space show before, but it's important to keep all of that in mind. So it's the totality of the environment that's important.
John, you were on the show with Adrian and Tom Lang and myself, and you heard him say he didn't think that gravity, artificial gravity, was going to work. Do you remember what he actually said about that and why he said that when I asked him that question?
My recollection is that the engineering problems become really significant if you have to have a large radius, and you have to have a large radius to avoid the effects on the equilibrium vestibular systems in the body. Those are all the things that Tim was referring to when he was talking about Coriolis forces. But physically, Tim is absolutely right. Given an effectively infinite radius, you can't tell the effects of artificial gravity induced by spin from regular gravity, except with very, very sensitive experiments.
Okay, there are no further questions. I want to go on. I got a lot more.
Yeah, I bet.
Okay, thanks, John.
Thanks, John.
Bye-bye.
You bet.
Listeners, That is, the line is available, 866-687-7223. Go ahead.
All right. I want to bring up another subject, which is really mind-boggling. My whole interest in space medicine was triggered by the fact that I studied three extraordinary runners. One of them was in the Guinness Book of Records for having completed 524 marathons, simul. Another one was a gal that I studied who ran across the United States in 64 days at a stage race. That's 2,900 miles that she covered in 64 days. She did beautifully. Came in third out of 13. But the one that I want to talk about now, and it introduces the subject of iron, and is Mary Hannadell. Mary Hannadell is now lives in Sweden and married Rune Larsson, who is Sweden's leading ultramarathoner in Sweden. And I studied Mary in 1987, prior to my going to Guangzhou, China. I was invited as a member of the North American Fitness Delegation to China, and I studied Mary Hannadell and Sai Ma as role models because both of them were running extraordinary amounts. When I studied Mary Hannadell, she was getting ready for a 600-mile race between Sydney and Melbourne, Australia, and that was about a month off. She was getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, running 18 miles 7 days a week. Then she went to the YWCA, swam for a half hour, then she worked in a department store from noon to 8 o'clock at night. And does that sound extraordinary? I'm sure it does. Well, when I studied her, her performance on a treadmill, I've done about monitored over 5,000 maximum treadmill stress tests, her performance was lousy. And I could, when I was running, I could have gone another 3 or 4 minutes beyond her, and I was shocked. She was the 1987 United States Ultramarathoner of the Year in 1987. Well, I can understand now, or I can understand the next day why her performance was so lousy. She only had half her blood volume. She had been bleeding chronically from the gastrointestinal tract for probably months, without knowing it. And long-distance runners tend to have this problem of chronic gastrointestinal bleeding, and often, unless they get laboratory studies, they may just think that they're fatigued because of their running and not realize that they have been bleeding chronically from the gastrointestinal tract. I'm concerned that this is going to happen in space, along with all the other complications, that we're going to have people in space who are going to have chronic gastrointestinal bleeding because the body just cannot take the stress of microgravity, and the body cannot take the stress of this great degree of running. And the gastrointestinal tract says, look, if you're going to send all this blood to the brain, because the brain needs it, and you're going to send this blood to the legs, and you're going to send this blood to the heart, the hell with the GI tract. Now, that's what I said before and on a previous program. So what happens is the gastrointestinal tract lining sloughs off, and when it does, one has chronic gastrointestinal bleeding. And this is going to be a problem eventually, and I don't know whether it's been published or reported, but we are going to have experienced people in space who are going to have gastrointestinal bleeding because, I told you, the gastrointestinal tract doesn't function properly, and because there's invariably in space a significant decrease in magnesium, there's going to be an increase in adrenaline, and with it, vicious cycles and an insult to the lining of the blood vessels. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up about Mary Hannadell is when she went to Sweden, her husband, Rune Larsson, who was L-A-R-S-S-O-N, when she went to Sweden, Rune convinced her that she should ingest regularly blood pudding. And in Europe, blood pudding is often ingested. It's the combination of cow's blood mixed with flour and fat.
Yes.
And as Mary Hennedell started taking this, and after a few months, her menstrual periods came back, whereas she had amenorrhea prior to that, and that often happens with long-distance runners. But also, whereas previous to her going to Sweden, she had one stress fracture after another, over and over, and this happens with long-distance runners. You cannot subject the body to this. And lo and behold, when she starts ingesting this blood pudding week after week after week, and in Sweden and in many places in Europe, this is available in a delicatessen, she stopped having stress fractures. And I wrote a letter to the editor, and again, I would like you to do this if you would just go down to the second, I think it's the second paper, the second paper, go to the list of articles, and I think it's the second paper, Our Ancestors Had It Right. It was published in the American Journal of Cardiology in 2000, and you shouldn't have any difficulty seeing it, and you'll see Mary standing on the treadmill, and that good-looking guy standing next to Mary is me about God knows how many years ago, and I was doing a stress test on Mary. Now, this is very, very important to me because this blood pudding, obviously, is a source of iron, and the gist of the letter to the editor that I wrote is that the gastrointestinal tract might serve as a very important physiological gate, so that the body absorbs just exactly the right amount of iron. Not too much, not too little. The whole problem, or not the whole problem, but many of the problems in space are that we really don't know what the dosage should be, and because we're faced with malabsorption. For example, I just got through telling you about the importance on Earth of the 2-to-1 calcium-magnesium ratio, and I really didn't tell you all the mechanisms, but you can find it in that paper that I published, American Journal of Cardiology, all the mechanisms. But in space, we don't know what the intake should be, whether it should be the 2-to-1 ratio or 3-to-1 ratio or 4-to-1 ratio, or we just don't know, and it might take years to find out. But what I'm stressing is the fact that Mary, by taking the iron, got exactly the right amount because the gastrointestinal tract ensured that that would happen. Now, I've been to Africa 8 times, and I've observed the Maasai. And as many of you know, the Maasai, about at least 5 months a year, 5 months out of the entire year, drink a combination of their cow's milk and blood. They bleed their cattle for at least 5 months a year and drink the combination. I've been in the Maasai huts in the Ngorongoro crater in Tanzania. I photographed the Maasai ingesting their milk and blood, and I've been in their huts. And the interesting thing is that the Maasai, apparently, I'm not sure, God knows whether it's been published, but they're not plagued with these recurrent stress fractures and probably amenorrhea and all the other problems the long-distance runners have, because they're getting exactly the right amount of iron. Now, I have told you before that when you look at the submarine, that excess amount of iron is bad because it increases oxidative stress, and that in turn can damage the blood vessels, can shorten one's life, and can create havoc. Now, there have been published reports that an increase in iron may slow down bone formation. Now, that's important because if we're going to give iron to our astronauts in space, we have to be very careful that we give exactly the right dose because it can slow down bone formation. And that determination is going to be very, very difficult. So that creates a problem, especially in the problem of malabsorption in space. How are we going to give it? And I'm not advocating that we start giving blood to astronauts in space. That would be absurd. But keep in mind that all of us should keep in mind the knowledge that we could acquire from anthropology. We have the same genes we had 50,000 years ago. No, there's no evidence that our genes have changed at all in the last 50,000 years. And if you, the bushmen of the Kalahari Desert, and I've flown over the Kalahari Desert, they can chase an antelope, the bushmen can, for 2 days, and then they throttle it, which means they choke it. And that's probably the way early man survived prior to the crudest of weapons, by chasing down their antelopes, and then after 2 days, the animal dropped from exhaustion, they would just simply throttle it. The Navajo can do this. The Tarahumara Indians of northern Mexico can do this, and the Aborigines all have this capability. But the Bushmen of the Kalahari can do this without a single drop of water. Without a single drop of water. Now, how do I know this? There's an anthropologist by the name of Robert Hitchcock, who's at Michigan State University, who has witnessed this repeatedly over a 20-year period. When he sent me an email about this, God knows, 6, 7, 8 years ago, I still didn't believe it. And Bob Hitchcock sent me an email from South Central Africa, of someone who's also witnessed this. Now, how in the world do they do this, and could we duplicate those genes in space? Most of you, or many, some of you might know that water is stored primarily in the skeletal muscle, some in the skin, but primarily in skeletal muscle. Well, the Bushmen of the Kalahari must have a fantastic reservoir for magnesium, for example, in the skeletal muscle. About 60% of magnesium is stored in the bone, and the other 40% is stored in the soft tissue and skeletal muscle. So the Bushmen of the Kalahari must have an enormous capability of storing water. Bob Hitchcock has said that occasionally they may find a melon, but if they don't find a melon, they can still do this for 2 days without a single drop of water. So they have the gene capability of doing this.
Bill?
Now, the reason I bring this up, I'll just have one more point.
Yeah, because you've got an important caller on hold.
Okay, I've just got one more point to make, and I'll quit. The point is that we should really study these people, find out what their gene advantages are, and then in selecting astronauts, use those particular genes to determine what those genes are and how we can use this in selecting astronauts. Okay, Dave, go ahead.
Dr. Deere is on the phone for you. Hi, Paul. Welcome back to the Space Show. How are you doing?
Hi, I'm doing well. Thanks, David.
Bill, can you hear him okay?
Yeah, I may have trouble with your connection. I've had trouble before, Paul, but I'm awfully glad you called. All right, Paul.
Hi.
By the way, Paul.
I'll try and keep it simple and clear. I had two questions, really. My first question is, as regards the effects of spaceflight, now we're assuming that all of these diverse effects that you see are due purely to microgravity, but at the same time, astronauts are under many different stresses, and they're in an unusual environment, they're in a confined space, and so on. So there are lots of different factors impacting on their physiology. Has anyone done the controlled experiments to determine which effects are due purely to microgravity and which are due to other aspects of working in space? Is there a control experiment?
Are you asking me?
Yes, he's asking you.
Yeah, Paul, I don't know that answer, but that's, of course, very, very important. What you're asking is, is it possible to tease out the ingredients that cause the problem, so we can determine which ones those are without looking at the whole picture? And, you know, I told you there are only 500 people ever been in space. That's a very, very important question, and I don't have an answer for it, Paul. But It's a great question.
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me that's the first thing that you need to tackle, because that's something that can be addressed by research on Earth. I mean, the one thing that you can do on Earth, you can't duplicate microgravity, but you can duplicate all of the other stresses that, you know, astronauts are placed under. So in principle, you know, it should be possible to duplicate those stresses and see if any of these other effects, which we assume are due to microgravity, are actually due to simply working, for example, in low atmospheric pressure that's rich in oxygen, or simply, you know, the levels of stress or whatever. So that was the first question. But my second question is also looking at it from a biological point of view, which is, if these effects are due to microgravity, you know, how much is known about the mechanism by which they're caused? Because it seems to me that that's the first thing you need to understand if you want to look at this from a biological or a medical point of view, is what's the primary effect?
Well, I think I've addressed that. And the problem with microgravity is that the adrenaline levels are twice as high in microgravity as in the supine position on Earth, and we know that. That's been well accepted. In 1995, I presented my first paper in Toulouse, France, and I argued that based upon the Russian studies, the adrenaline levels must be elevated in space, and it took, even though the Russian studies had shown experimental animals the adrenaline levels are elevated, I had difficulty getting that across to the group there, and the person in charge said it might be 20 years before we find out. Well, in about 2003, it's been well established that the adrenaline levels are elevated, and with the adrenaline elevation in microgravity, invariably about twice the level as on Earth in the supine position, the adrenaline undergoes what we call auto-oxidation, and therefore the adrenaline is conducive to oxidative stress, and that in turn damages the lining of the blood vessels. It causes what we call lipid peroxidation, which I sent you an email about that, and that lipid peroxidation, or oxidative process in the cell membrane, that damages the cells, and ultimately the cells die. And with elevations of adrenaline, there's an increase in free fatty acids, and that increase in free fatty acids causes a decrease in magnesium ion, and you have a vicious cycle. And then, and that's been well established, and I've published a great deal about that. In addition, there is an elevation of a vessel constrictor called angiotensin. That in turn causes an increase in release of aldosterone, and with aldosterone, there's an increased loss of magnesium ion and another vicious cycle. So the bottom line is, and I'm sure I've snowed 95 or 99% of our listeners, but the point that I'm making is that there are multiple vicious cycles in space, multiple. I have in front of me, if all of you sometime would look at an article that I published in 2004, called The Case for Subcutaneous Magnesium Product and Delivery Device for Space Missions. And I have three figures there, and I have really gotten a lot of hits with this. This week, I must have physicians who are reading my website. I think that I've gotten about 250 hits looking at those figures this week, in the last 6 days of this. I have three vicious cycles in that article, and the problem in microgravity is these vicious cycles damage the lining of the blood vessels and do all sorts of other bad things, and it's an ongoing problem, and the only way to break these vicious cycles is to give adequate magnesium, and the only way to give adequate magnesium is with subcutaneous magnesium, and there is, at this time, no replenishable subcutaneous magnesium, no subcutaneous device to administer magnesium.
Okay, but with regards to that, I mean, it seems that the magnesium problem is sort of secondary to whatever problem prevents normal absorption of magnesium.
I don't agree that it's secondary. I think it's part and parcel of the whole problem. Let me tell you this. I just published an article in February about the fact that that life expectancy can be shortened by inadequate magnesium, even though this, we know that 60% of the world population has a magnesium deficiency. 60% of the world population has a magnesium deficiency, and the problem with magnesium is that the serum level is not sensitive because 99% of the magnesium is intracellular. So that the only way to get around that problem is either to empirically take magnesium, empirically, and get a kidney function study once a year, because the kidneys must be functioning properly, and then so that you can adequately excrete it, and or to do an intracellular magnesium test, and that's extremely expensive. There's a man by the name of Bert Silver, a PhD, who lives in California, who has developed a marvelous, accurate test to do an intracellular magnesium test, but it costs $240 to $250. I called them about 3 months ago, and that's the existing price. So it's out of the range of large epidemiological studies which would answer the question. But we know that even though the sensitivity of the serum magnesium in space is very poor, the sensitivity of the test is very poor, with 99% intracellular, the serum magnesium level in space is still significantly reduced to a P level of 0.000, less than 0.0001. So therefore, it's highly sensitive test showing that the serum magnesium is reduced, even though the sensitivity is that poor. And that is the bottom line, I think, of a major problem in space.
Okay, but ultimately, it still comes down, or it's still dependent on disruptions to other aspects of the metabolism and absorption. One question is, if I can imagine that elevated adrenaline is going to cause all kinds of effects because it's a very powerful stress hormone. What happens if you very simply give somebody beta blockers in microgravity? Does that alleviate or ameliorate, any of the effects of microgravity?
I'm having so much trouble with that, with your line.
Can you give someone...
Give me the last sentence. The last sentence is the question. Give me just the last sentence and have David...
yeah, sure. So the question was, I suspect that adrenaline lies at the root of a lot of these metabolic knock-on effects. Has anybody tried the simple experiment of giving astronauts beta blockers?
Okay, so Bill...
About using the beta blockers, Paul, we cannot use pharmaceuticals of any sort until we get a subcutaneous replenishable device, because we can't give it orally. Then the problem also comes up, and I've addressed this numerous times, that because of impairment liver and kidney function, we are opening up a can of worms by giving these beta blockers, for example. It's a good question, but God, I wish to God that we could use beta blockers and reduce the effect of adrenaline, but it would be very complicated to do this with the we just don't have a device to give this medication subcutaneously. Plus, I'm very glad you raised this. The other problem is this, Paul. I checked about this, and I called up. I've got several friends who are in the pharmaceutical business. The pharmaceutical companies are not interested in developing subcutaneous medications other than insulin, because there ain't no money in it. There ain't no money in it, and it costs billions and billions of dollars, and then the potential lawsuits. So there really basically isn't any subcutaneous pharmaceutical available, almost none, except insulin. So this is going to take years.
You're in a sort of vicious cycle there where, you know, you're saying that you can't give a drug that may ameliorate the effects of microgravity because microgravity prevents absorption of the drug. What I'm arguing is that if the elevated adrenaline lies at the root of some of these metabolic problems, including, you know, liver and kidney function, then potentially you might forestall that problem by giving beta blockers from the outset so that you don't develop these problems to do with absorption.
It has to be a day in and day out, 7 day a week proposition. You can't just give the beta blockers before you go up in space and ameliorate the problem. You'd have to give it day in and day out. I know a lot about this because I was in private practice for 34 years. And I've mentioned on this program that there are all sorts of side effects of pharmaceuticals. One of the programs, the physician's desk reference weighs 8 pounds, and there are probably 4 pounds of side effects. I've mentioned this before. And I wrestled 7 days a week. I was in solo private practice for 34 years, and it is hell to administer pharmaceuticals on Earth, and in space, it's going to be much, much worse and much more complicated. Everything in space is just put in a factor of 10. It's going to be much more complicated.
Yeah.
Oh, I don't know if I've answered your question. What you're trying to do as a research guy is to simplify this aspect, and it can't be done, Paul. It just can't be done.
Yeah, I mean, sooner or later, somebody needs to pick apart this effect of microgravity, you know, down to the initiating factors and down to the bottom-level causes. But I take your point. I mean, there's no quick fix.
Your point several years, well, I don't know, within the past year was, you and I discussed gene therapy, and you said that you're going to open up a can of worms by doing this. It's too complicated. What we just have to do is duplicate one G, and then everything will be fine. But then my argument has been, how are we going to explore when we get there, and how are we going to build tunnels, et cetera? And if we can't do these explorations, then why not just send robots? And then we're back to that argument.
Sure, yeah. I take your point.
Okay. Anything else, Paul?
No, I think that covers everything.
Thank you very much.
I'll speak to you both again soon.
Good to hear from you.
Hey, listen, Paul, I got your paper right in front of me here. One by one, single molecule tools for genomics by Paul Deere.
Yeah, that was me.
That's you, isn't it?
That should make some nice bedtime reading for you, Bill.
You wrote this, did you, Paul?
Yes.
I did, yeah.
Yeah, he wrote it.
Your mother didn't help you, did she?
I'm sorry, I missed that.
Did your mother help you?
No, I believe that was all my own effort.
All right, thanks, Paul.
Thank you very much, Paul. Good to hear from you again.
Enjoy your bedtime reading, Bill.
Thank you. Okay, so listeners, we cleared the line, and I have another question for you that is relevant to what you were talking to about Dr. Deere. It's an email question from Martin in Minnesota. Back in February, there was news of the first test in humans of an implantable device that can be programmed to release daily doses of medicine in a patient with no interaction required from the patient or the caregiver. It was used to deliver medicine for anabolic osteoporosis treatment, something called human parathyroid hormone fragment.
Parathyroid,
yeah. And he gives the URLs for it. I emailed you the thing, and then he says Microchips is the company behind it, founded by a group from the MIT technology program. So I sent you his email because it's got the URLs in it. Are you at all familiar with this, and is this a stepping stone to what you're talking about is needed?
Well, I'm not familiar with that, but that certainly is a stepping stone, and this is what we need. We need a lot of stepping stones such as this, and the problem is that it's so complicated, and everything one tries, then we have hundreds of complications related to that, and this is the problem. But that certainly is a step in the right direction.
Bill, if it was easy, Marshall Dillon would have been on the moon, and we would have had horses and everything going up there, you know,
right,
hundreds of years ago.
Right.
Here's another one from Terry in Corpus Christi. Dr. Rowe, in talking about separating out vitamins and the discussion that you've been having, what about multiple vitamins and B3 on a daily basis?
I would stay away. away from it. I stay away from it. I want to live as long as I can.
So you would stay away from taking the daily multiple vitamins?
I would not take any multivitamins. Listen, what I do, and what my wife does is this. Both of us take magnesium supplements. Both of us take magnesium citrate, 200 milligrams twice a day with meals. It has to be something that is well-absorbed. The magnesium citrate is well-absorbed. And I take 100 milligrams of vitamin D6 only to enhance the effect of magnesium because Mildred Seelig suggested this to me 20 years ago.
D6 or D3?
B as A, B, B6, B-6.
Oh.
That's pyridoxine, 100 milligrams once a day. Pyridoxine, that's vitamin D as in A, B, B6, once a day, 100 milligrams. I take 1,000 international units of vitamin D3 once a day, and I take nothing else. I walk 4 miles a day, 7 days a week, and I take a high magnesium diet, and I'm very, very careful. Let me add one more thing. The Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert, who can chase those animals for 2 days without a single drop of water, they eat 300 mongongo nuts every single day. M-O-N-G-O-N-O, mongongo nuts. So I've had all sorts of friends say, hey, where do I get those mongongo nuts? Well, I don't think you can get them there, but I would strongly urge, I think that every kid, it would be great if America and all the other countries of the world could afford to teach anthropology in high school. Read the book, The Paleolithic Prescription. The Paleolithic Prescription, and another one called Man the Hunter, and learn something about anthropology. These mongongo nuts will, once they fall to the ground, are drought resistant and will last for an entire year. And I have a lot of listeners who are interested in Africa and interested in the Bushmen of Kalahari. That's another article that I wrote gets a lot of hits. And I don't want to take the time fishing through this right now, but I wrote it probably about 10 years or so ago about the Bushmen of the Kalahari. Read that article. It's very simple to understand. And they're phenomenal, and we've got to do something about analyzing their genes and try to find out what in the hell makes them, allows them to run to this level for 2 days without water, and then use those genes in making selection for astronauts.
Bill, we'll probably wind the show down in a few minutes, but you know, because I get so much email from listeners all over the place, not just here, but around the world, in fact. And they all want to go to Mars, for example. I'll just pick on that. In the past week alone, I've probably gotten 30 emails about humans to Mars because there's this, a Dutch company has gotten a huge amount of PR saying they're going to start one-way missions to Mars in 2023 and send more humans every 2 years and until they have a settlement of 100 on Mars and on and on and on. And they say, you know, David, is this real? You know, what do you think? You know, on and on and on. And others want to have a new Mars conference, and ours is going to be different from every other Mars conference. And the first thing I'll start replying to people is, how are they addressing the human factors? Now, between you and Dr. Jurist, I have been pounded on the head on the reality of human factors in space beyond what any mortal wants to ever be subjected to, except that the education I've gotten from the two of you is really reality-based, and it allows me a perspective to very quickly look at what's being sent me an email and decide whether it's crap or there's a possibility for education with the people or something, okay, that might, you know, command a different kind of response than thank you, you know, I've seen that, I appreciate your letting me know, keep listening to the show, you know, something like that. But overwhelmingly, Bill, overwhelmingly, the kinds of things that we're talking about today get rejected in the space enthusiast community, either because it rains on their parade, and nobody can have that happen because we have to go to Mars because it's going to save humanity. You've heard all of this before. Or because they heard Dr. Zubrin's very eloquently expressed and inspirational plans to do Mars in 10 years, or Elon Musk say it. And then here we are listing all of these issues that to these people seem like insurmountable barriers, and all of a sudden we're the enemy. And, you know, in a way I kind of get sick of dealing with it, and it just keeps going and going. And I don't know that you have a solution to it. I mean, we try to do these programs for education and to let people know what's really out there and what some of these issues are. And, you know, it's really frustrating to me as to how hard it is to provide a reality-based education to people who want something so bad that they're ready to go tomorrow, or they believe that if they want to kill themselves, they should have the choice to do that on whatever rocket is available to take them there, except in the back of their mind, they clearly don't think they're going to kill themselves.
Well,
I don't know. Maybe you have a comment on all of this. I'm really frustrated with it.
Well, the only thing I can say is where I'm coming from. I had 34 years of private practice in internal medicine and cardiology, and I had a three-year residency program, and that's my background before I ever got interested in space medicine 20 years ago. So I would say that if those people who are involved in space medicine would have a background of that, 34 years in internal medicine, I think a much larger percentage of these people, of the investigators in space, would agree with what I'm saying. I think that I love the fact that your listeners have a passion. I think that's what makes the world go around, to have a passion for something. And I admire these people for that, but frankly, they really don't have the facts straight, and that's all I can say.
Well, I hope people listen objectively to what you've been giving us today and putting out there. And I know it's a hard pill to swallow when your belief system is challenged. I have a belief system about other things, and it's a hard pill to swallow when it's challenged. I contend that we make human spaceflight happen, and we can do this when we build our foundation on really solid ground in reality, and we're able to go forward either incrementally or maybe through serendipity with breakthroughs. But if we're in denial about it, or we want to poo-poo it or ignore it or not deal with it, whatever foundation we build is like quicksand, and it doesn't hold up. So,
absolutely. Can't argue with that, David.
So, I mean, that listeners, I know many of you will take issue, and you'll say Bill is negative or something like that.
I certainly would invite anyone to send me an email, but make sure you put some thought into it, and I'll try to answer your questions. But I want, I'd like to, it'd be nice to have a question which shows some real thought. And if you do, I'll be glad to answer it the best I can, or write a comment when David archives the program, and put a comment there, and I will try to answer whatever comments you have. But I would appreciate it if you really have thought through the thing and not just had a wish list, but something that is where you're actually facing reality.
Yeah, the goal is education. We're fine if you disagree with us, but not just because you're a true believer. You have an email from Paul Deere, and he says, after hearing this, I'm wondering how NASA is going to get a Mogongo tree and a herd of Maasai cattle on the next manned mission.
Well, I don't know what Paul's talking about.
No, where he's just having fun with the Bushmen of Kalahari and how they're able to
Kalahari, huh?
Yeah, and how they're able to to do things. So
I wish Robert Hitchcock would have joined us. Robert Hitchcock keep you for a minute. Robert Hitchcock has spent the last 20 years of his life concerned about the plight of the natives in Africa who have no source of water. For example, the New York Times had an article about 2 weeks ago about the Niger, N-I-G-E-R, and these are a group of Africans who live in West Africa. I think that it adjoins the Congo. And the school children cannot go to school, don't have time to go to school, because they spend most of their day looking for water for their families. Now, they're not the Bushmen of Kalahari. These are the Niger. But Paul is very, very interested. Robert Hitchcock, not Paul. Robert Hitchcock has spent probably the last 20 years as an anthropologist from Michigan State University trying to help these people down there and trying to raise funds to help them. And I think that everyone should keep this in mind about how fortunate we are in living in a civilized society where we have access to water and don't have to contend with the problems that these people have in Africa.
Amazing. So they have to spend their time looking for...
The school children, the young children, the family delegates that to the children. And the children spend much of the day doing this, and they have no time to go to school. They may have to walk 4, 5, 6, God knows how many miles a day to try to find water. And Paul, Robert Hitchcock. Robert Hitchcock is an anthropologist, is trying to help these people. And he sent me some articles about this, and he and I have corresponded over the years. And I was hoping that he would come on the program along with this brilliant guy. I can't remember. I think his name is Paul Deere.
Well, Paul Deere did come on.
I'm just kidding.
Why aren't the World Health and UN and international relief agencies doing things with these people? Haven't we heard of it?
David, maybe they are, but I don't know if they are or not. Robert Hitchcock could give you an answer. And I certainly am indebted to Paul Deere for, again, calling into the program and sending his emails. Paul is just really an outstanding person, and it's just a pleasure, and I've had a great deal of pleasure corresponding with Paul Deere over the last couple of years.
Bill, what's your best bet? Is this a problem that you've been talking about today that can be solved by money, or is it a problem by well-founded research over time, or both?
I think, number one, you have to face reality, and I think that some investigators don't face reality. Let me tell you this, David, we've talked, I think it's over 2 hours and 15 minutes. Thank God my bladder is held up. But about 2010, Fitz, F-I-T-T-S, was on your program.
Right, Jim Robert Fitz, I think, right?
Right, Fitz was on your program, and he mentioned the fact that the soleus muscle, S-O-L-E-U-S, is reduced by about 35% after 5 months in space. And he published the article. It's a marvelous article. And when I saw it, David, I gave you a heads up about that article right away and suggested that you have him on the program. And Fitz was on the program, and he did a marvelous job. But what his final paragraph is that this loss of skeletal muscle after 5 months, 35% in the soleus muscle, that's in the lower extremities, we need, the astronauts need more exercise. But I have shown and pointed out over and over in published peer-reviewed articles that both too much and too little exercise in space will damage a perfectly normal heart, and there is no way at this time to establish an exercise program. And I have no idea how to write an exercise prescription in space, nor does anyone else. And if anyone else can write a decent exercise program, which is really going to hold up with peer review, I'd sure like to see it.
Yet the cosmonauts and astronauts are exercising all the time.
They're exercising, but there still is a deterioration of 1 to 2% loss in the bone every single month, and a loss in skeletal muscle. I went over to Oslo, Norway, I'm trying to think, maybe about 15 years ago, to talk to Kjer Rodahl, R-O-D-A-H-L. And Rodahl is one of the leading
exercise physiologist in the world at that time. He and Astron, A-S-T-R-A-N-D, wrote a marvelous textbook. The last one was published, I don't know, about 15 or 20 years ago. And his solution was that astronauts are going to have to exercise 15 minutes out of every hour, waking hour. So if you've got 16 waking hours, that will 15 minutes out of every waking hour will put you up to 4 hours of exercise a day, but then you would have to take a psychiatrist along, because who in the hell can exercise 15 minutes out of every waking hour? The problem is that microgravity is a problem in space, and so far no one has able to solve the physiological problems involved with it.
So it's not just an issue of money.
I think it's an issue of money also, but it's not just the money. They've been pouring money into this for years, and no matter what they pour into it, it isn't enough. But that's not all the answer. I think that many people involved in space research haven't had enough background in the practice of medicine from a practical standpoint to really understand what the problems really are, and they're looking at a very, very small component of a huge picture, and I think that's part of the problem.
Your best guess, if we were really committed to solving all of this, the humans to Mars in 15 years, 20 years?
I'd say 50 to 75 years.
Okay, now, final question for the show. We've got a burgeoning, developing, very exciting and encouraging private sector. Totally private mission to Mars someday, let's say it's feasible, and the people don't care. They sign the disclaimers, and they don't care anything about what you've been talking about today. They want to go, even maybe a one-way Mars mission. Your thoughts on that?
What happens if someone has a heart attack 10 days after liftoff?
Well, what if they don't care, and they die?
They don't care, then the hell with it, but that's not science. That's not science. That's something for dreamers.
I mean, well, that's what they want to do. They want to go live on Mars.
Fine.
So
let them go. Fine.
So you say
fine.
Let them go.
Let them go. Fine.
And so that's really the kind of mission.
I don't see any difference between that and somebody saying that they want to swim from New Jersey to the English coast,
or climb Mount Everest.
One of the most dangerous. I'm off the subject now, but one of the most dangerous sports events of all time, absolutely, is open water races, where there isn't a boat accompanying each one. You've got just a few seconds before someone loses consciousness and he's gone. And unless there's a boat accompanying each one, that's way off the subject, that's probably the most dangerous competitive sport there is. But anyhow, these dreamers, why don't they just swim from New Jersey to England?
Well, because they want to go to Mars.
Well, if they want to go to Mars, but I think that before they go to Mars, they should see how difficult it is just to swim from New Jersey to England. David, I guess the program is just about over, and I really greatly appreciate your asking me. It's really an honor to be on your program.
Okay, so just I want to clarify, the Dreamer mission, as you're talking about, not at all related to the kinds of things we're talking about today. If someone wants to go do it and they have the money to do it, God bless them, go. And if they make it, fine. If they don't make it, that's their choice.
Right.
You're not interested in stopping them from doing that.
My God, no.
Okay. I just wanted that as a point of clarification.
No.
Yeah, I didn't think so. Not from a guy who walks in the river with crocodiles all around him.
That's when I was immature.
Do you have any pictures of that you can send me?
Oh, I have numerous movies.
I'm fascinated with alligators and crocodiles. So
I don't know. Anyhow.
All right, listen, Bill, until the next time, my friend, thank you very much.
David, thanks very, very much.
And listeners, that's it for today. And look at the newsletters for what we've got planned. Open lines this Tuesday evening. Anything is fair game and fair topic if it is space-related. Thank you all. Special thanks to Dr. Rowe for staying with us for 2.5 hours and for all of you who participated. Goodbye from Bill and myself.